on this Memorial Day, we're talking with U.S. Marine Corps veteran Danyon Brinkley, who's had multiple near-death experiences, knows more about dying than pretty much anyone, who created a wonderful program to make sure that no American veteran needed to die alone, to provide sort of a bedside counseling that prepares people to make the transition. It's done it for thousands and thousands of veterans and wants to do it, a training that would help people in hospices to prepare for what comes next. What does come next? What has he learned about what's on the other side? And Paul Perry, knows more about the subject perhaps than anybody who hasn't actually had a near-death experience, has done some really interesting research that we'll touch on in this hour about multiple people who drag the living along with them. They have a near-death experience, and somebody who is still on this side travels along to verify that the experience really did happen. We'll get into those topics and more right after this on Coast to Coast AM. Before the break, we're making some comparisons between the UFO field and phenomena and the near-death experience field and phenomena. And I guess the similarity, the most striking one, is that how people react. You know, generally, the overall information is positive, but it shakes the ground under people. It shakes their beliefs, and they react in a negative way often. And I guess there's no getting around that right now, but maybe eventually we get used to it. You know, Danyon, when I see how people react to your message, which is ultimately incredibly positive and reassuring. You don't die. Don't worry about it. You're not going to hell. And they're saying, yes, I do die. I mean, I don't know what their position is, but do they want to take the opposite of that?
Well, because everybody has to stop, George, and pay attention to the fact that you only have X amount of breath that you breathe in this life. And the universe pays attention to you breathing. Okay, and that's the bottom line. You come to breathe X amount of breath, and that's the end of that story. So finality is an inherent part. Like, I was writing a book called 10 Things to Know Before You Go, and then I got sidetracked. But the number one cause of death in America is birth. And if you're breathing, you're leaving. And if you don't put that as a quantifier about who you are and what you're doing in your life, you're missing all the real reasons you're here. Okay? And I just happened to be fortunate enough, and I paid the price to know the real reasons for why I'm here and what I'm supposed to be doing, and I've focused on it, and I've stayed focused on it for 45 years, ever since I got up, and I've stayed focused on it. So when I take a look at where the world is and how I see it, by being able to make a difference, because if you live in Las Vegas, Nevada, and you don't believe there are extraterrestrials, just from living here and being around the dynamics of Area 51 and Tonopah and Groom Lake and all those different places that we all know exist in Goldsburg or Goldstone, we all know those places exist. And to think that there's not extraterrestrial beings in and then working within this dynamic is foolishness if you live in Las Vegas. But I was thinking about what people do. Where does their religious mindset go at that point when they have to accept one of the core beliefs that they're the only ones here? Huh. You know, and all the levels of angels and all that stuff has to come into play at the moment that reality is accepted.
Paul, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, that's all.
And then people actually, once they see something that changes their long-held beliefs, they can get angry about it. They can say they didn't see what they saw, or they don't feel the way they really feel. And that creates a lot of friction within themselves and sometimes within the family. That's fairly uncommon in near-death experiences. For the most part, near-death experiences are transformative experiences, and they're transformative in a good way. A lot of doctors describe them as being, once a person has a near-death experience, they become type A without the anger, which means they really want to get a lot done in their life, but they're not angry the way most type A people are. And in some ways, I think to say, I mean, George, you would know better than I, but I started reading a lot of case studies from Lynn Kitai's files. Lynn Kitai is a medical doctor in Arizona who's been doing research on the Phoenix Lights for the last 25 years.
Right.
And she has hundreds of case studies of people who have written to her and talked about the effect that the lights, seeing the Phoenix Lights, has had on them. And I see them as being transformative experiences in a positive way that are very much like near-death experiences, are much like the way near-death experiences positively transform people. I don't know if you see them the same way, George.
Well, I think there's comparisons for sure. I mean, Danyon is Exhibit A. He's the different person than he was before that the first one happened. That's for sure, right? The word you use, Danyon, is a redneck. You're a bully, and
I mean, come on.
You're still kind of a bully, some.
Well, true, but you know, I grew up a tough guy. I didn't think about this kind of stuff. I grew up a tough guy, and I'd knock you out. I didn't have a problem with it. It wasn't a problem. And so the thing that was so transformative was that I could come to a place in the Panoramic Life Review where I control my destiny, where I was in control of it, and I had a point of comparison to look at this next life. If God couldn't come today and they sent me, if I was going to be practicing, I believe that this life is that you get the honor to come and practice being a god. And if you take a pencil and paper and you write down everything that you think God is, loving, caring, compassionate, all those things, then you think of how many times per day do you have the opportunity to do those things, to be caring, loving, compassionate, thoughtful, all those things. Well, it's all day, every day. So that means you're practicing being a god. So when I look at it from that point of view, all right, knowing that, then I do get bent out of shape over hypocrisy and things like that. But I went from a person that only cared about myself to a person that cares about how people deal with something that does not really happen. You will not die. It will not happen. So how do people deal with that is the focus that drives me forward. It will not happen. No matter what everybody sits and thinks, no matter what they believe, no matter what the televangelists tell them, it's not going to happen. And so I just hold that point because I know it's true. You know, so the best part about all of it is how do you convey sensibly in the crisis that we exist in America today, and basically in the world today, how do we find the best method to get this viewpoint and perspective out there that is generated from what is now called the near-death experience. And then you have to also deal with the fact that so many people, because of so much of us raising hell out here who've had this experience, it made it easier for Raymond, for other doctors to come and tell their story, but that was as far as it would go. But if we hadn't have been out here yelling and fighting and carrying on and keeping this term, the near-death experience, out there as a way to look at the possibilities of other options in life, then Raymond wouldn't have been able to have all his guide people telling him and accepting this. But so when you listen to people tell you about a near-death experience, you need to get more detailed in listening to them to see what was occurring when it happened. Because a lot of times people use that term, George, they use that term to tell a story because it's now mainstream. We have driven this term and this existence of this phenomena into mainstream reality.
You can tell the difference, though. You can tell the difference, right? You can tell the difference between the real deal.
Everybody who's had experience has a sound. Well, and Paul can go do this also. But everybody, to me, George, everything has a sound to it. Everything has a certain frequency and a certain harmonic, and I listen to that. Paul knows this. You know this. When you're talking, I'm listening to the frequency and the sound of your voice, and it gives me insight into the nature of a person and how they operate. And I use that when I'm at the bedside, which creates for me the shared near-death experience, which is the real secret for why I died with so many people, so that I could experience and touch that glorious place and not have to go through what I have to go through to be able to get there, called the shared experience. But when you first started talking about this stuff, I was here. When you first started talking about this stuff, I remember what people were saying about you. Okay, and here you were just being a good investigative reporter, you know, and there's so many stories here, you know, look at all the places that you went. I mean, I thought it was pretty phenomenal when Paul said how people relate to it, always go to the religious viewpoint. Okay, how would you religiously look at that when that has to be accepted? Okay, because politics and religion, finance and social economic psychologies and, you know, where people's goals are play an important role in all of that. And all that has to be just taken into consideration to get people to the place that they give themselves a moment to think that they're not gonna die. It's not gonna happen.
I'll tell you, the scariest part of this whole thing is not dying. It's the life review as you describe it. It's different from what has been described by other people. It's the fact that you not only see it yourself, but from the viewpoint of everyone you ever encountered, and that, and you've had to go through it each time.
Right, that's life changing right there.
Oh my gosh.
No, yeah,
that's the most life changing component about the whole experience. It's the punchline. If you live in America or you live in the world today, and you look at the near-death experience and you look at the similarities that people have, you know, some it's a tunnel, it's a sense of separation, but there is consistent factors that have been brought forth, and Paul is an expert in these. One of them is the life review and how you see it. Well, mine are always, as like the rest of my life, it's always complex and filled with drama because I'm such a, you know, I'm just me. And I have to be that person that I'm interacting with. So I know that when I have to interact with all those people who keep telling me who I'm not, because they're arguing with who they are not, instead of listening to me try to lay a groundwork of this is what we have to do, everybody, or you won't see your way out, or you won't see exactly what the boxes of knowledge that came in 1975, that we wrote in 1993 and published in 1994, are happening today. That would reinforce that there's a life after death. There's a consistency in the fact that I'm very perceptive. Everybody around me knows all that. That's not anything new to me, and everybody has the same skill set. You just have to learn how to set up intention to do it. But until you face the greatest thing, which is that you're not going to die, okay, and how you frame that religiously or any way that you frame it is okay with me, but we have to get people there. I mean, there is going to be a massive, and I won't say die-off, but there's going to be a massive place that, based on looking at how medical structure is today, that's going to keep people at home. Everybody better get ready, because this is what's going to happen if the boxes of knowledge are right, and we've been through this for 25 years, Paul and I. If they're right, then this is where we are. So tonight, as I celebrate the Memorial Day and the veterans, it is the most perfect occasion for me to get a chance to tell this part of what I'm trying to do, why I'm trying to do it. And I apologize to everybody whose feelings I hurt, but I don't really care. You know, I'm going to tell people the truth.
So much for that apology.
Paul, you've done some really interesting work with Raymond Moody, who I interviewed on the show about this a couple years ago, not realizing that you had co-written this book about a shared near-death experience where a person leaves their body and they take somebody else along.
They do, and that's one of the most exciting things to me is, you know, a near-death experience is a collection of events that take place when someone is about to die. But the only, generally speaking, the only person who experiences that collection of events is the person who's dying. And that makes it a very subjective experience. So in other words, when they tell you what happened, they talk to you about their life review and so on and so forth, you have to take their word for it when you hear it, because it's subjective. But there's another type of experience called a shared death experience that's objective. And that means that people who are, at a person's deathbed, for instance, they share the death experience of a person who's dying. And you might have two or three people who will share that experience at the same time and report the same events. So, you know, the person who's dying goes ahead and dies, but there will be two or three people at the bedside who will see a mist rising from their body, or they'll experience the person's life review, or you can have what's called a crisis experience where a loved one or a friend isn't expected to die, but dies in a distant place, and they appear to you generally at night. They appear to you, and they report that they've died, or they just stand there, and you have the sense that they've died. And later on, you report that to somebody, and then you find out in a day or so they indeed have died. So those are shared death experiences, and they're objective experiences. You can actually prove that they happened. And to me, that's a giant step in this whole field of near-death studies, because once you start to study case studies from shared death experiences, you realize that there is existing proof that consciousness leaves the body and that consciousness survives that leaving. And that's a whole different path now.
Because for so long
we spent a lot of time studying near-death experiences, but now to move into shared death experiences is a whole different animal because of the objectivity.
But conscious connectivity too, as you're describing it, Paul. Remember, as a person has that shared experience, that's why I created the training for the Twilight Brigade, Compassion Action, the Twilight Brigade, how you enter that realm to engage in, and I always just say the euphoric perspective. All things are viewed from everything that Paul is saying, George, is viewed from a euphoric perspective. You are consciously in the zone of that level, I call them densities, of that level of transition. You are consciously there with them because you took the right attitude, you set the right intention, you paid conscious attention to that breathing, or there was a unison or a bonding psychology that had that to happen. I mean,
these experiences can be definitely be inspired, right? As a person is dying, if you talk to them about the death process and they can calm down enough, they can actually be inspired to experience a shared death experience. Is that correct, Danny?
No, I would agree. Sure.
Yeah.
I mean, when you start to realize that there is a process by which you leave, the body does what it does, but you are not this body. There is no way that, even though it has emotional and physical pain attached to it to keep you from making you think it's you, okay? But it's not you. You are not this body. So moving out of this body has a process to it. It's step by step. Like George said earlier, you know, I've been a hospice volunteer for 43 years. I spent 37 years in the VAs across America, being at the bedside of 2,010 people going from this world to the next, and have accrued more than 34,000 hours at the bedside. When I start to talk about death and what I know about it, it's equally important to what I've done and what I've tried to do.
Hold on a second, Daniel. I want to continue that thought on the other side, but we got to be going to a break. You know, tens of thousands of hours spent at the bedside of thousands of dying people, many of them veterans who are alone and understandably scared about what, if anything, comes next, and then successfully putting them at ease, that's what counts for me. As I evaluate the life story of Danyon Brinkley and Paul Perry's books, that's what counts for me. I hear the distant yammering of a few who say none of it's real. When you're dead, you're dead. The proof is in the pudding for me. The results, reaching out to people who are lonely and afraid and making their final moments on this side less onerous, less fearful, that's real. The results matter. We're talking with Danyon Brinkley and Paul Perry. We have one final segment coming up, and I hope you're sticking around with us. Danion, can you give us an idea about what awaits us over there? I mean, you know, it depends, I guess, on what you do here, where you end up over there. You can be in a gray zone, purgatory, whatever you want to call it, or and do you have free will? Are you still you? What do you do for eternity?
Well, this is another part. This is, I mean, thanks for moving to this part, George, because after Paul and I went through two of these experiences, the struck by lightning, and I was struck by lightning 3 years later, George. Remember how funny this is. I was talking on the telephone in another house doing the exact same thing, and lightning, and it was earlier in the afternoon, and lightning struck the tree, and it knocked me against the wall. I was still holding the phone. It knocked me against the wall and threw me forward and knocked the frame of the window out into the yard. Okay. So I was unconscious about 45 minutes. So I guess I was doing a little better, but I hadn't fully transformed my personality to suit them. So they just gave me like a wake up call. But I never believed in ghosts and all that kind of stuff. It wasn't a part of my life, equal to the two near-death experiences, ghosts and spirits and possessions and things like that. I never paid any attention to it. And then the third near-death experience, which was brain surgery. Remember, I was struck by lightning, open-heart surgery, brain surgery, open-heart surgery. Nobody's going to tell me I don't know what life and death is. Okay, so I got a grip on it. So in the third one, George, it wasn't long. I mean, I had the panoramic life review. I lifted out of my body, but I was in a different place than the first two. In this third one, I was in a place where I was watching them drilling holes in my side, shaving my head, and put this machine and drilling these holes in the sides of my head. Okay, and I watched it as I was at the bedside, and the tunnel forms to my left, which is always to my left, and then I start to move down it, but it's like peeling an onion. You know, there's layers of me letting go. I'm becoming lighter and more refined as I go there. So that place in the first two experiences, I thought, was a transition place where you acclimated from the world you were leaving into this place so that you were present in the next level of consciousness, but you could still see what was going on and you had a better viewpoint of it. Okay, so for the third time in brain surgery, and it was that this place was a level on itself. It occupied a conscious level itself. And there is where I realized that there is a layer where free will stays in place for people who hold on to things and people who are sociopaths and, you know, I won't say demons because I don't have an understanding of demons, although I research it all the time. But there are levels where people get trapped and they stay in this place that they can always want to come back over here, always want to come back over here. So when I saw that that place existed, and I saw so many veterans who felt betrayed after they had to deal with what war is. I mean, and this is what I saw most about that third experience. I created the Twilight Brigade because I could do something about that, knowing what I had gone through, being a... Well, I always say, if I didn't go to hell, nobody's going, because I know who I am and I know what I've been through and what I've done in my life. But if it operates this at each of these times, it's the same process. Nobody gets away with anything. Nobody's going to save you from anything. When you came here, you took responsibility for your life. You took responsibility to try to make it better than you found it. And it's how you look at that and how you make those decisions. But if there is a consciousness that's called the shared near-death experience, George, and there comes the next stride like Paul is describing, that's the next stride. And then to formulate the ethereal spiritual strategies so that people can come and prepare for that person's transition in all the right ways and all the right thoughts in the right place and share in that euphoric perspective. That should be the goal that we take on. Because once you have that connectivity, I will personally admit that many of the times at the bedside of the people that I've been with going from this world to the next, I miss that place. I don't have any problems with honestly saying I miss that level of consciousness that moves and vibrates and expands me without me having to consciously think about it. I expand and connect to all these levels and identities and consciousnesses, and we all have that. We just don't experience it until we let go of this one. And so the shared near-death experience has practical application, then there has to be that we make a move to create a way that people can have that kind of experience, as Paul is reinforcing his research on it. I know it's possible because I know how to do it.
Well, currently, actually, there's a number of different types of shared death experiences, but the hottest one right now is something called terminal lucidity, which is the reemergence of mental clarity shortly before death. So what that means is that somebody who has fatal Alzheimer's, fatal dementia, and brain, you know, fatal brain tumor disease in their brain, and they have no brain waves, they will often reemerge. They'll have, all of a sudden, they'll have mental clarity. They'll come out of it, even though they have no brain waves, and they'll talk to people at the bedside, even though they haven't spoken for days, and everyone thought they were terminal. And they'll be like that sometimes for minutes, sometimes for hours, sometimes for a day or two, and then they pass away. But many of them never regain brain waves. And what that indicates is that there's something that takes over as we die. There's something that takes over from gray matter, and your which is your brain, and it turns into a mind-controlled body, which is essentially what the brain does, is create mind. And what you have in that case is proof of separation of brain and mind. You have separation of consciousness from the body. And that's the hot spot right now in shared death experiences. That's what everyone's starting to look at. And the reason I brought that up is that the National Institutes of Aging and the National Institutes of Health have now funded 6 studies to see how they can create terminal lucidity in people who are dying from brain diseases, because they know it can happen. They just don't know how to make it happen. So that's the first time I know of that the federal government has put money into anything resembling near-death studies.
Well, there are pockets of research into consciousness around the world that are popping up now, and it's encouraging that science is at least taking it seriously and trying to figure this stuff out. There are so many people on the phones waiting to talk, but I have to ask this question. How to prepare for what comes next, Daniel? You've hinted about some big stuff that's coming, and it doesn't sound encouraging on a global sort of a human level. But are there steps that people can take to prepare? And are there things that they need to know about your work and Paul's work that how to help you?
Well, I mean, I think that coming together and working on a program that becomes a functional way to do shared near-death experiences, I knew somewhere on this show tonight, George, I would find the way that I've been looking for, that how can I get people to start paying attention? And if I can create a way that they can do what I know I do, there's legends and footage of me pulling somebody and giving them into that euphoric place. Okay, what Paul was just talking about, we in the dying business, call that say, okay? A person comes to say goodbye, and you can usually time when it's going to happen. It's usually when they come conscious. Mom's going to come home. She's going to get well. That's the mindset. Every person who's listening to me knows that this happens. Call say, because you come to say goodbye. All the drugs and all the morphine and all the cancer and all of that cannot stop that spiritual being going to have to leave this body because it won't function anymore, saying goodbye. So we call it, say, I've probably seen it in dramatic fashion, probably 200 times. What people have to pay attention to right now is their health care. Paying attention, okay, and having to know that you're going to have to take responsibility, personal responsibility for your health care, managing your diet, managing what you're focusing on. Because if you don't, the system that we call health care and the system that's evolving will trap us. What will you not do to protect your parents, protect your children, and protect yourself? In reality, where is the only place that all three of those positions in conscious reality of who you are in this plane, this physical plane, can be held in jeopardy? Okay, if you're a Mexican cartel, yeah. Okay, but health care. And when you look at the atmosphere that we're living in, everybody has to do certain things to protect everybody else from them. So It blocks and creates loneliness, and it creates separation, which is a psychology that leads to despair and fear. Okay, people are breaking out of that mindset, but that's the mindset that the boxes of knowledge said would bring into existence. So when I watched that happen, George, what am I supposed to do? Something about it. Well, tonight I have that answer, the shared near-death experience. Thanks, guys. you're in, Paul.
Well, I also want to say something a little more positive about all this, is that in the last year, we've all lived through, and we're coming out of it now, I hope, an international near-death experience.
And agreed.
You know, some of it involves literally having near-death experiences, and others near-death experiences in other forms, economically, friendship-wise, on and on. And what I'm anxious to see is what positive comes out of this international near-death experience. What kind of positive aspects are going to come out of it? Because it's very similar to a near-death experience with, you know, in many cases, with the exception that there's no actual near death, but there are transformative aspects to what's happened. So what I'm interested in is over the next couple of years, what kind of positive transformations come out of the COVID experience and the international near-death experience that came from it.
Let me try to get one call in here before we're out of time. Sure. First-time caller, Diane in Los Angeles. Hi, Diane. You're on with Daniel and Paul.
Hi, George. Thank you for having Danny and on. Oh, my God. I listened to you when my daughter was born 43 years ago, which was shortly after you experienced, I think it was your first one, near-death experience. And then you had taught some classes that I took. And then I became one of your compassion and action.
Thank you.
I don't know. I think you called us angels at the time. And then my life got insanely busy, and I never was able to take advantage of what you had taught me. But it was extremely valuable when my closest and dearest friend was dying, and I was able to lay in bed with her literally 24 hours before she passed away. And she was heavily dosed on morphine, and I didn't think she could hear anything I said. So I
every word.
I did the, you know, what we were taught to do. And
anyways, at the
time I had to leave her, and because nothing in her body moved, no matter what I said to her. So I was pretty sure. So then when I left her, I said, you know, when you're on the other side, let me know, you know, you've made it and you're okay and everything. At that point, her eyebrow went up like, are you nuts? That was very valuable information, and I thank you for that.
But Diane, listen, simply in the last call of the evening, the value of my whole life comes to like full circle, so that I know where I am, and I know I'm on the right path, and I know I'm doing the best of my ability what I think is the truth about what's happening. And George, it's not always mundane or horrible, okay? This is a part of us having to make choices about the quality of our life and the value of what we're doing here. If you're not going to die and you're going to experience this, you have to make choices about it. Most people is not taking care of themselves. I'm notorious for it, but not as bad as most, because I don't have any choice but to take care of me. There's no choice or I'm done. So that's the key. And to get ready, we live in changing, shifting times. Okay? And when you have a changing, shifting time, you start to hunt a savior. Okay? Because I wasn't going to ask you this question. Where do most of the people who have to accept that there are extraterrestrial and interdimensional realities, where do they normally go in their religious belief system at that point?
Well, a lot of them who have experiences, direct experiences, become more compassionate. I mean, it really sounds like they have the same transformation that near-death experiencers have.
And see, that means there are good beings out there. So it means that they're good, you know? I mean, I think that when I learned how this all works and what sparks people's nature to be transformative and to re-look at their spiritual identity and who they are as a being as opposed to a human. And if we don't do that, then the kind of tragedies that happen from us not taking care of ourselves and the shift and change in the global world as we see it, and by not taking care of ourselves is the first thing that we're going to see, that we lose control of our lives.
Right.
I mean, and if the boxes tell this, and anyone who reads Box 12, it's called Technology and the Virus, and it describes all of this that's happened, and Paul and I wrote it 25 or 6 years ago. So there's the life after death. If that chapter is right, there's the life after death. Number one, it's telling you right where you are today. Just where we go from there tonight, George, I'm going to come back to you and Paul, and we're going to have a bull session.
I'm in. Daniel Brinkley, it's always great to talk to you. I always feel good after I talk to you. And Paul Perry, we're going to spend some more time together. I want to have a further conversation with you. Thank you both so much for being here, and hope people will go back and read what you've written a long time ago.
Yeah, thank you so much.
I love you, George, and I love you too, Paul, and thanks so very much.
All right, we'll be in touch. Thanks also to my earlier guest, Wayne Pacelli, of Animal Wellness Action, and my colleagues there at Coast to Coast, Michael Cosio and Donna Walker, our webmaster, Lex Lonehood, tonight, Dan Galani and Chris Boros. I'm George Knapp. I'll be back in a couple of weeks, everyone. Take care of yourselves.